Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest. May 2nd, 2024, the Should Student Protesters Be Arrested edition. I'm David Plotz from CityCast. Crow update. There's now a cat stalking in the yard next door, and the birds are extremely agitated. I haven't seen an outdoor cat in my neighborhood. The birds do not like it. Crows are not picking up the things I'm leaving for them.
That happens to me all the time.
Yeah. You guys don't pick up the things I leave for you either. John Dickerson from the CBS Daily Report. Hello, John Dickerson.
Well, thank you for using its new name, David. I feel affirmed.
From the New York Times Magazine and Yale University Law School and the Yale University Law School Daily Report, Emily Bazelon. Hello, Emily.
Hi, David. Hi, John.
Imagine if you had to do a daily 90-minute show about Yale University Law School, Emily.
Oh, my God.
On the other hand, you would have lots of ready people available to bang on for 90 minutes about things, wouldn't you?
That's
You'd
true.
Have sources all
That
around
is absolutely
you.
True.
Yeah.
This week on the Gabfest, police arrest 1,000 anti-Israel protesters at campuses across the U.S., Columbia, Fordham, Dartmouth, NYU. Counter-protesters attack an encampment at UCLA. Campus after campus after campus is paralyzed by student activism. Who was right? Who was wrong? Is this invigorating student activism? Is it anti-Semitic vandalism? Is it a performative tantrum? What is it? Then, who could possibly be against judges considering history and tradition in their rulings? Emily Bazelon, that's who. We'll talk about Emily's fascinating new piece about history and tradition in judicial rulings. Then, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem admits to murdering her own puppy and a goat in her new memoir. Will it help her get on Trump's ticket? Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title the Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
What an extraordinary week it has been on university campuses with the showdowns over the pro-Palestinian anti-Israel protests. In Columbia, the ground zero, the cops called cops on the protesters for the second time, this time to expel and arrest students and others who took over a university building. There were also arrests at many, many other universities. The last figure I saw was more than 1,000. There are encampments, battles over encampments on dozens of campuses. I would say we're at the never wrestle with a pig phase of these protests, where it's clear that no matter who wins, the university is going to lose. Student protesters have put university leaders in impossible positions, and university leaders have responded by doing really improbable and probably mistaken things. So, John, you live just down the street from Columbia, practically. Should Columbia have called the cops to expel protesters from a campus building? Should you ever call the cops on student protesters? Is this an occasion when you should?
Those are two great questions. I would just tweak the open just a little bit. Sorry, I'm getting out of my lane here. But
seriously, man. Yeah,
but it's my day job. There are some universities where things were resolved, Yale, Johns Hopkins, Brown. And I think, at least in the case of Brown, which I know a little bit more, I'm not sure that the college administrators came off badly. I mean, I think they found a resolution. They basically agreed to have a vote in October on divestment. Anyway, that's obviously not the majority of cases, but it's just one little part of the story. Should they call the cops? First time, no, probably. Like, maybe definitely not call them the first time. Occupy a building, not leave when given plenty of fair warning. Yeah.
I mean, it's hard. You sort of want to wind the tape back, right? I mean, let's take Columbia as an example. If you go back to this moment, it feels a long time ago. Maybe it was just like a week and a half ago, where The president of Colombia, Manu Shafiq, was testifying in front of Congress. She kind of threw free speech values and individual professors under the bus in front of Congress. Like, she knew that the president of Harvard and the president of Penn had lost their jobs by not sounding like they cared enough about anti-Semitic speech on their campuses. And she wasn't going to make that mistake. So then she came back to campus to a lot of like real distress about that testimony and an encampment, which the students had cleverly set up in the early dawn right before she testified. And I've been told by people at Columbia, or I've been doing some reporting, that she then felt like she had to act tough because she had basically just told Congress she was going to do that and kind of set herself up. And then things like unwind from there. And I think you have the sense on other campuses that, you know, Columbia lit a spark, which is now traveling around the country. I was talking to a Wise former administrator who was saying to me that when students are upset about something, and they really are upset about the war on Gaza, you have to figure out as the university not how not to become the vector for their rage. And that is absolutely not what happened at Columbia. It was the total opposite. And I think Shafiq kind of created reasons for that that were real. But then we also have to ask, you know, whether the response from the students was wise. And to even use that word is kind of funny, because I think we have this idea that like we're always supposed to side with the youth or be sympathetic in some way. But on the other hand, like often students are unwise as well.
But what was Shafiq supposed to have done? She was in an absolutely impossible position. And I feel like she made a set of choices that were probably not good. She shouldn't have called the cops, but she would have lost her job. And
because
she was going to be a ritual animal sacrifice under all circumstances except her cracking down on the students with cops.
As little power as Congress has in so many areas that require collective action from Congress, it's amazing that in this area, following the chain of reasoning I think you were touching on, David, with which I agree, Congress has an enormous power. It caused this behavior. I mean, I don't think it caused this behavior. I think isn't the whole deal about having morals and a code and a set of standards that when those standards come in conflict with people you think are acting in bad faith, and I think it's probably safe to assume here that Columbia administrators thought that the members of Congress who were pillorying them were acting in bad faith, that your job is to sacrifice yourself for the things you believe in when you're in one of these jobs where you're trying to promote the belief in things you believe in. And that giving in to the performative aspect of this, while it might have been politically beneficial in the short term, one of the reasons you have these standards and morals is not just because they're good on their own basis, but also because in the long term, they end up kicking you in the ass when you break them.
Well said. Let's remember that federal funding is a significant fraction of the budget of these big private universities, right? They are directly beholden to Congress, so they can't thumb their noses. But I think, to take your more principled stand, John, I mean, one thing that has been missing in this testimony generally is like a full-throated defense of free speech on campus of like, yes, we are going to let people yell things that other people find completely unacceptable. And that's part of our learning community. Now, there's a limit on this, which is a federal statute called Title VI, which says that you can't have discriminatory or harassing speech that rises to the level of a hostile environment because it's severe or pervasive. And Shafiq, interestingly, in the last week has said that the protests have created that kind of hostile environment in Colombia, which is a sort of admission of being on the brink of liability. But I think she also said it in order to lay the groundwork for calling the cops again when the building was occupied. Anyway, there's this tension there.
But Emily, nobody can make that principled defense of free speech because there are very few university campuses where that's actually been the habit in recent years. I mean, I assume this is why University of Chicago is in a safe is the school that is like skating through this, because University of Chicago has sort of allowed that.
Yeah, there was a really interesting letter from their president. He said, look, we like you're saying, so Chicago has both a principle of institutional neutrality for the school itself called the Calvin principles and these principles from 2014 that are like very pro free speech, very not in the mode of like, we're going to have safe spaces on campus for students. And we think that if students are wounded or offended by speech, including hate speech, we're going to do something about it. Chicago does not do something about it if they don't have to, which they really don't. Most of the time. And so this letter was about like, hey, we let pro-Palestinian demonstrators set up a huge exhibit on the lawn honoring our martyrs. We let it stay up. We've been given lots of opportunities for expression. Now we have an encampment. We are not happy about that encampment because it breaks our time, place, and manner rules. And we're going to explain to you that the reason we have those rules is if we let you occupy a part of the lawn permanently, that means other people can't have that same right of speech. There's like an exclusionary aspect to these encampments, right? Now, you can say that this is like exaggerated because there are plenty of other places on campuses to go, but it's not nothing, that argument. And then the president said, look, in the name of respecting and honoring self-expression from students, maybe we'll let the encampment stay up for some amount of time. We're not going to like rush in immediately, but we're monitoring this. And also, we're just asking you to respect our rules. Like, we have these rules for a reason. We will make lots of spaces and lots of time and manners for you to protest, but we're asking you to limit this particular kind of protest, which is against our rules and in the end does create some disruption and can create some safety problems for schools. I don't want to overstate that stuff, right? But it's not like it's zero.
One interesting thing I'm looking for, obviously you got now involved the mayor in New York, Eric Adams, who said there's a movement to radicalize young people and I'm not going to allow that to happen. That seemed to be referring
it's good that
to
it's up to him.
Yes, yes. Well, it seemed to be referring to what he said were outside agitators, and what our correspondent Michael George, who was up there covering this for us, pointed out, which I think was really smart, is 109, I think, is the total number of those arrested at Hamilton Hall at Columbia. At some point, there is going to be a number. How many of those were students? And it'll bring the lie or the truth of this question of outside agitators, which is maybe a small point, but I think is not unimportant because part of this is, I think part of the justification for the military or the police response is these weren't students. These were agitators. And there's obviously been some reporting of people who are known members of the community, not students, who were agitating. So that'll just be an interesting way to actually test this not unimportant fact.
Emily, you point us to this interesting John Chait piece in New York Magazine where he talks about why this has been such catnip for the right, and for three reasons that Chait points out. One is that it's an issue, the issue of Israel and Gaza genuinely divides the left. So the more focus there is on it, the more division there is with the left, number one. Number two, it promotes this image of chaos that is at the heart of Trump's narrative and the sort of MAGA narrative about America, that it's chaotic, that like the left is, you know, making our cities, our universities into squatter encampments, you know, occupied by Palestinian radicals. And third, that it's fuel for people who believe in sort of an extreme, that it drives people to extremes. And that's also helpful. Why were you struck by that? I mean, besides the fact that I just summarized it.
I was struck by it because I think that there's this inevitability about the way in which these protesters are going to play in the hands of Republicans and of former President Trump running for president. It makes the university seem totally out of control. For many Americans, it's very alienating. I think a lot of students are super upset about the war. The war is terrible. So many people are dying. It is also true that Students for Justice in Palestine, the group that is leading a lot of these protests, has a much more radical agenda. They are rejecting any kind of two-state solution. It is not just about a ceasefire. It is about eliminating Israel. That is their platform. They are very clear about it. They are the people who rejected the Oslo peace process in the 1990s, and that is what they want. And so the students following them can be very heterogeneous in their beliefs, but that part of the protest in the leadership is there. And so that is something that like does not have majority American support. And that's why it's a useful wedge issue for Republicans. And there's also a kind of irony here about targets, right? Universities are the institution in American life that have done the most to nurture the left and develop it, right? I mean, these ideas about anti-colonialism, which are so prevalent in these protests, they are coming out of the universities. And yet the universities are already are also the target. And I get why, right? Like the universities are big organizations and they have investments hidden or sometimes disclosed in all kinds of different things. And divestment is meaningful. Like it did in some way probably affect the fall of apartheid in South Africa. At the same time, there are a lot of other targets, military bases, congressional offices. You could come up with a lot of other things where you would have a more direct line to actually changing policy on Gaza and on Israel and Palestine. And so, you know, look, like if you choose the universities, that is going to be very useful for the right, which already has lots of grudges against universities and feels excluded for them and is used to like, right, making fun of them as this kind of elite, out of touch part of American life.
I wonder on that divestment question whether that analogy still holds. I'm just questioning because Israel's a different place and investment is, we're in a different investment environment, whether the corporations would, let's say the schools leave, those companies still get, I mean, it's a symbolic victory, but would it actually affect the behavior of those companies in the market the way it is right now? I wonder.
Yes, very good question. And I just myself did not mean to be making Israel equivalent to South Africa. I was talking about the effect. I just want to be clear about that.
Yes. And I wasn't suggesting you were doing that either. I wasn't. I was just wondering with the difference, you know, Israel's, as companies would make these think this thing through, the Congress is now investigating. There are now a series of investigations in this, which is along the line, I gather, of what Chait is arguing, which I didn't read. But the driving chaos to sell order, you know, is a longstanding political tactic. Particularly, it's got a kind of a double benefit because, you know, it both riles up your own base, and then it also has a kind of a general, to the extent there are any undecided voters left in the seven states that are going to determine the election, it has a kind of middle of the road appeal to voters that Trump otherwise doesn't do so well with because he is the agent of chaos with no, a lot of times without any solution or order, but is just total chaos.
Yeah.
I'm now going to channel my friend Beverly Gage, who was saying to me that this is how Ronald Reagan built his career. It was opposing the student protesters. This is how he became governor of California, like, and proved himself. And, you know, it was useful to Nixon too. So, yeah.
I mean, it's extraordinarily useful to Nixon in both 68 and 72. I mean, Nixon was, like, if you think of it from a policy perspective in 72, Nixon is not that popular. Like, Nixon is associated with the war, and yet it's the chaos of the anti-war protesters in a lot of ways that benefits him.
Speaking of chaos, we should all obviously remember that that Democrats are going to Chicago this summer, and mischief makers and the news networks that are dying to re-show their 1968 footage is going to like create its own weather.
Just to close the segment out, the House passed the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act with majority Democratic and Republican support, and Senate still has to pass it. Biden would have to sign it, but it does classify a bunch of speech about Israel as anti-Semitic, sort of making claiming the existence of the state of Israel as racist would be anti-Semitic, applying double standards to Israel that are not expected or demanded of any other democratic nation, and drawing comparisons of contemporary Israeli policy to that of Nazis would be classified as officially part
and
of the definition
what happens?
Of anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
What happens is that the education department can then, if universities do not crack down on that speech on their campuses, if student holds up a sign that calls for from the river to the sea, then the education department says, well, you're not cracking down on the speech. You're fostering this. We're going to take your research grants. We're going to investigate the hell out of you for this.
Wow, that is so interesting. You know, I was at Columbia on Monday, and this was hours before the takeover of Hamilton Hall. And it was like this very kind of festive atmosphere. I actually felt like I was at a happening with like dozens or even hundreds of students marching around the quad, chanting, and a whole bunch of faculty kind of locking arms and protecting the encampment. And the students were chanting some things that this act of Congress would rule out. They were chanting that Israel is a racist state. They were chanting at one point, we don't want no Zionists here. And, you know, listening to it, I guess I would ask, like, if you can think this speech is unacceptable, you can wish they wouldn't say it. But the idea of an authority figure ordering them to stop talking, is that something that universities can really do? And is that really the right way to address students? Once it becomes socially acceptable to chant things really loudly with hundreds of students, like, what is the best way to try to address that issue?
I want to thank our Slate Plus listeners. You have helped us keep the Gabfest going for so long. And as a Slate Plus member, you get lots of great stuff. You get discounts on live shows, bonus segments for other Slate podcasts. You get unlimited reading on the Slate site. But you also get a Slate Plus segment from us every week. And this week, we're going to talk about the overturned conviction of Harvey Weinstein. How did it happen? Was it the right decision? So if you are a Slate Plus member, again, thank you. Enjoy it. If you're not a Slate Plus member, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member today and hear that bonus segment. This episode of the Gabfest is sponsored by Aura Frames. Are you ready to win Mother's Day? Cement your reputation as the best gift giver in your family. Give the moms in your life an Aura digital picture frame preloaded with decades of family photos. That mom will love looking back on childhood memories, seeing what you're up to today, checking out grandkids, checking out cousins. And even better, with unlimited storage and an easy-to-use app, you can keep on updating your mom's frame with new photos so that it's a gift that keeps on giving. This is how I live in my family. I gave my mother an Aura frame. It was either for Mother's Day or for her birthday. She absolutely adores it. She's constantly hectoring me to update it with more photos, which I do. I also gave my girlfriend's mother an Aura frame, and I hope she hectors my girlfriend to update it with more photos. But it is a present that will bring absolute delight to a mother in your life. And they have a great deal for Mother's Day. Gabfest listeners can save on this perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code GABFEST at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. This episode of the Gabfest is sponsored by Aura Frames. Are you ready to win Mother's Day? Cement your reputation as the best gift giver in your family? Give the moms in your life an Aura digital picture frame preloaded with decades of family photos. That mom will love looking back on childhood memories, seeing what you're up to today, checking out grandkids, checking out cousins. And even better, with unlimited storage and an easy-to-use app, you can keep on updating your mom's frame with new photos so that it's a gift that keeps on giving. This is how I live in my family. I gave my mother an Aura frame. It was either for Mother's Day or for her birthday. She absolutely adores it. She's constantly hectoring me to update it with more photos, which I do. I also gave my girlfriend's mother an Aura frame, and I hope she hectors my girlfriend to update it with more photos. But it is a present that will bring absolute delight to a mother in your life. And they have a great deal for Mother's Day. Gabfest listeners can save on this perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code GABFEST at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
A collision between a Chinese jet and an American spy plane.
He came and rammed into our left wing.
With relations increasingly strained, what are the chances of things spinning out of control?
The Western world was asleep.
I'm Gordon Carrera. I'll be exploring the friction in this most important of relationships and asking, has the West taken its eye off the ball?
You cannot ignore China.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Shadow War, China and the West. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
It is always a red letter day on the Plots calendar when Emily Bazelon has a new article. No different this week with... I'm not being ironic.
That's so nice of you.
I read everything Emily writes, basically.
You are the best.
How history and tradition rulings are changing American law. Some Americans believe in history and tradition, not Emily Bazelon. Emily, what are history and tradition rulings? What is wrong with them?
The tension here is about whether courts should consider history and tradition as like a relevant factor or whether they should view it as binding on them. And the Supreme Court in 2022, in three cases, said history and tradition is going to be how we decide whether things are constitutional in really important areas of American law. So this was, first of all, Dobbs, the ruling that struck down the right to abortion in Roe versus Wade. The second case is a religion case in which they found that this high school football coach who was gathering people to pray with him at midfield after games, like, that was fine. He was not allowed to be fired by his school. And the third case is about the Second Amendment and striking down a New York gun statute as being inconsistent with American history and tradition. So this sounds a little, or might be reminiscent of originalism, right? The sort of philosophy that Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas believe in, which is like you go back to the original meaning of the Constitution, the words in the text, and what they meant in 1789 or 1868, if you're talking about the 14th Amendment, and you just stick with what they meant then, and you don't allow those words to develop meaning over time, even if they're words like liberty and due process and equal protection that are like kind of deliberately majestic in the words of some former justice whose name I'm embarrassingly forgetting. Okay. So originalism looks at least, originalism was never consistent or perfect. And it was also a way of kind of binding the law to the past and not allowing the Constitution to evolve. However, at least on paper, it was like tethered to a particular moment. It had some kind of limit, right? And that was supposed to be good because it meant that the judges had to stick with that moment and they couldn't impose their own values. They just had to go back to what the framers meant in 1789. History and tradition is like totally all over the place. Like you get to pick which history and tradition. When does it begin? When does it end? And when you look at Justice Alito's approach to this in Dobbs, you see that it's just a big excuse for cherry picking. I mean, I am sorry. Like it just is. But because of that, I think there's just this suspicion about what the Supreme Court is doing here on the part of conservative as well as liberal scholars. And it really comes down to this idea, and this comes from Jack Balkin at Yale, is history a resource for judges or is it a command? And if it's a command, and then you can pick whatever history you want, what's really happening here?
It's judicial Calvin ball. You know what Calvin ball is, right? You change the rules of the game while you're in the middle of the game. Either that, or if you've ever seen the movie Stripes, where John Candy describes to the new guy. Now, if we were in Germany, you see, I'd make your bed.
Wait, what are you doing? No, get off. See, you got to make my bunk. See, we're in Italy. The guy in the top bunk has got to make the guy in the bottom bunk. He's got to make his bed all the time. See, it's in the regulations. See, we were in Germany, I would have to make yours. We're in Italy, so you gotta make mine.
Well, Calvin Ball is perfect because originalism was having some problems, like for overturning abortion, for example, because in fact, up until quickening, which is when women feel fetal movement, abortion was legal and permitted widely in colonial America. And so the originalist interpretation would have been very tricky. So, oh, lo and behold, now we have a new test, i.e. Calvin Ball.
Emily, can you actually, in getting to the sort of cherry-picking problems, just talk about Amy Comey Barrett's quite wonderful metaphor about this?
Yeah, she talks about looking over the crowd and hunting for your friends. And this actually is a phrase that judges have used in the past for other kinds of interpretive methods. Like when you are looking at legislative history, you can have the same problem. Like you pick the one member of Congress who said what you wanted, and then you decide like that's what Congress meant. And Justice Barrett was talking in 2023. She was giving a talk at the law school at Catholic University. And she sort of said, well, judges need to be really careful. It was a kind of warning, but she didn't really explain like exactly what they were supposed to do. And she was, you know, one of the votes for Dobbs, in which like there's a lot of looking out over the crowd and hunting for your friends.
First of all, we should just note interpreting history is super, super hard. Like, yes. Even if you're doing it in good faith, as I've tried to, and there's, you know, the presidency has all these special traps in it because there is this thing you can fall into, which is if a past president did it, it's part of the tradition of the office and therefore it's a good thing. But with no kind of second beat thinking, wait a minute, like, but if it was James Buchanan who did it, you wouldn't think that this is so great, even though it's a part of the tradition of the office. So you can fall in all these traps. And that's why I'm no historian. And that's why real historians are, you know, beset with all of this careful making sure that they're not bringing the present into the past, that they understand things in their context, which is like doesn't seem to be at play in some of these issues, which is a problem. But the other thing, Emily, is can you, the whole notion of originalism, maybe, tell me if I'm wrong, is that you don't want to have the whims of passion and self-interest and the mob in the moment overcome the rules that were considered carefully and sensibly from the beginning, or at least you want to put some scratchiness in the system so you mitigate against all of our natural impulses, which the founders studied so intently, which is basically our ambition will overwhelm all of our reason. So let's put some stuff in place. This historical interpretation that you've written about, the history and tradition, is like the exact opposite. It's like a really inexpensive street drug for anybody who wants to basically, you know, shine up whatever their basic like human impulse is.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of thinking about it. I mean, there's a law professor named Sharif Gurgis, who I talked to for this piece, who has this really interesting article called Conservative Traditionalism. And he basically just points out that, like, once you have what he calls, like, the dead grip of the middle past, you're going to have a lot of conservative outcomes. Like, that's just how it's going to go. It's not a coincidence.
Well, it's so, I mean, the things that are so frustrating about history and tradition, and as you describe it, Emily, is so there's the A, cherry picking. So you find what you want. B, history intrinsically in the United States, like anytime you look before arguably like 1965, but certainly if you look before 1900, it is a history that's written without huge groups of people having a voice in what that history should be or what the tradition should be. Because, you know, if you were Black, if you're a woman, if you're part of an Indian tribe, if you're, you know, certain kind of immigrant, you don't have a voice in shaping what the history and law is. So like the idea that we should return to that period is insulting and seems totally perverse. And finally, it's clearly like history in this context refers to some particular set of time, which it doesn't happen to be. History is not 1970 for these folks. It's never 1970.
It's never
1970. It might be 1870. You know, it might be 1890. It might be 1850. That's when history is. History is basically between like 1820 and 1906. Like that's history. And everything else is not history at all.
Yeah, totally. I mean, there's this great, there's a case this term, it's called United States versus Rahimi, and we'll probably get the decision at the end of June. And it's a gun rights case. And it's, I think, going to show-
Amazing case.
Yeah, it's this crazy case where the facts are so bad for the gun rights side that I think it's going to show that the Supreme Court does not really mean, does not really intend to be literal about applying the history and tradition test. So this guy, Zaki Rahimi, his girlfriend accuses him of like yanking her out of a car and pulling her by the hair and other bad stuff. And so the judge grants her a protective order. And part of the deal with the protective order is Zaki Rahimi is not allowed to have any guns. But then he goes on a couple shooting sprees, like over the course of a week, he's just like shooting off his gun. And the cops come to his house and they're like, oh, wait a second, you have guns and you're in violation of protective order. So then he gets convicted. This is under a 1994 law where that's then the reason for taking away the guns of someone under a protective order is to try to protect victims of domestic violence, most of whom are women, from getting killed. And there are studies showing that if there are guns around with someone who's a domestic violence offender, there is a much greater risk of homicide. So this all seems perfectly sensible and modern. But then the Fifth Circuit, which is a very conservative appeals court, overturns Zaki Rahimi's conviction, essentially says, like, yes, you get to have your guns. And the reason is that this law is what the Fifth Circuit calls an historical outlier. Because oh, guess what? Back in the colonial days, we didn't take guns away from domestic violent offenders. Another thing about the colonial days is that women couldn't vote and had almost no recourse if they were victims of abuse. They also couldn't own property if they were married. And so there's just this way in which the very standard itself yanks us back to this time that we don't want to live in anymore, that is completely at odds with keeping people safe now. And I just don't think the Supreme Court really has the stomach for giving Zaki Rahimi his guns back. So I expect them to somehow change the history and tradition test to prevent that outcome. But that will also be showing that this test, is this really a test at all?
Except to be fair, you can't really engage in a shooting spree without a gun.
It's true. It's a problem.
I mean, but of course, like, and I guess this is where liberal justices end up, which is that history, or a lot of justices end up, history and tradition, that's a box that we want to investigate. You know, the original intent, that's a box. Like, what, you know, modern standards are about this issue, what the legislation actually says that we're considering, like, all that it's a melange. It's a very complicated, nuanced stew that we're considering. It's not sort of one hunk of meat. And that's how you can reach an outcome.
Totally. And it makes sense, right? Like, if we had never ever done something in American history before, then you might want to think about, why are we doing it now? Like, if someone passes a law about something and it's just like completely unheard of, maybe that would be a reason for judges to think that it's a bad idea. Or maybe they would say, well, we never had this eventuality before, and that's why the history is so different, right? Like, of course, history should be relevant and considered and a factor. And that is, in fact, the way the judges have always talked about history in cases. It's not like they went around ignoring it before. It's this notion that it somehow is at once supposed to be dictating the outcome and utterly malleable that is the problem, I think, with the conservative majority's current attempt to use it.
I'm very tempted. I printed out my favorite quote, which is the Ulysses S. Grant quote about originalism, and which also bears on history and tradition. And I was like, should I read this again for the fourth time on the Gabfest? And I've decided I will not. But look up the phrase, the framers were wise in their generation and wanted to do the very best possible to secure their own liberty and independence. That's the phrase. Look that up and then read that paragraph that follows, which is the greatest paragraph ever written about America, in my view. After a short break, we'll be right back.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
Kristi Noem, governor of South Dakota, would-be Trump running mate, dipped herself into hot water this week when The Guardian got hold of her new memoir, No Going Back, The Truth on What's Wrong with Politics and How We Move America Forward, and found that it contains a shocking, horrifying story, anecdote, about how she murdered her own German wire-haired pointer puppy and a billy goat that she thought were bad animals. The puppy was untrainable and wild, and the billy goat was too aggressive. We can get into the details of the story, which are just insane. But she's positioning herself as someone who does what needs to be done in this dog-kill-dog world. But she did horrify the dog world with this. And I just want to note, I was horrified by the story for many reasons, but notably because when I asked my dog expert friend of mine what kind of dog I, David Plotz, would be if I were a dog, she thought about it for a while and she said, you, David Plotz, would be a German wire-haired pointer, which is a very active, curious, bearded dog that likes physical activity too much, points at things. And so the fact that Kristi Noem murdered a puppy that I always feel sympathy for German wire-haired pointers. Anyway, John. Discuss. I don't have, I can ask you a question, but just like start on this.
Well, the first thing that came to me would be an interesting intellectual exercise, which is provide 3 to 5 possible excuses that would be made by his supporters if Donald Trump had admitted to doing this. In other words, there is a line we have seemed to have found for behavior. And there's always, to me, an interesting question between the behavior Donald Trump himself can get away with and the behavior that those who are his acolytes can and cannot get away with, and where the lines are drawn and who draws them and so forth. If this were something Donald Trump had admitted to, there would be, you know, the normal retinue of Republicans who would defend it as being, you know, consistent with a lot of great, wonderful characteristics. Just Noam got caught on the wrong end of that. But it seems to me that the performative aspect of putting it in the book and I make tough choices is a part of that market that Donald Trump created, which I've talked about before, which is the same kind of political market that Matt Gaetz participates in, Marjorie Taylor Greene. It's the performative toughness. It's not unlike the market created by the You're Fired on The Apprentice, which is not the real world, but a fake world in which, so it's all, it feels like perfectly consistent in that. We should talk about the vice presidential sweepstakes later after we get off the dog issue. But I would say, after you go look up David Plotz's wonderful Ulysses S. Grant quote, go listen to Nixon's Checkers speech, in which Checkers is the name of the dog, how he deployed Checkers in the speech, incredibly talented. Secondly, the whole speech itself, which is a defense of why he should stay on Eisenhower's ticket, it's a really good speech. And boy, have things changed. But also all the norms that Richard Nixon, right, not considered by many people to be a paragon of norm maintenance, all the norms he's bowing to in that speech, which are now, you know, his party is in a post-norm period.
The only thing that made sense to me about the story was the idea that because there were witnesses to the dog killing, that this story was going to come out anyway, and she was trying to get ahead of it. The rest of it just seems completely just dumb to me. I just can't imagine that she really thought, like, oh, this is going to be a political asset. It's just like so bizarre.
And just to quickly brief on the details, so she had this 14-month-old puppy, wanted to be a hunting dog, took it out on a hunt with other dogs. Apparently, like all hunters say, this is not how you train a dog to be a hunting dog. You never take a hunting dog out with a group of other well-trained dogs for the first time. It requires a ton of training. The dog goes out on this first hunt. It is wild. It's having the time of its life, like, which is sounds like kind of great. Like the dog is having the time of its life. It doesn't respond to its shock collar because it's having the time of its life. And then it attacks some chickens. Not great. You don't want dogs to attack chickens at a farm. And she decides from this, the dog is untrainable. It cannot be. It is an incorrigible dog. It can never be. And shoots it on the spot. Like, or takes it to a gravel pit. Actually leads it to a gravel pit and shoots it. And the idea that you would make that conclusion after that series of events is so shocking and shows such a callousness about life is really stunning. But I agree with you, Emily, that probably someone else had someone else witnessed it and has a different version of it, and she's just trying to get ahead of it with a slightly more pleasant spin.
And yet, on the other hand, given the whole hang Mike Pence thing, the idea of the punishment not fitting the crime is rather consistent with the job of the vice presidency as conceived in a Trump administration.
Well, that's grim, as you intended it, I think. But I guess the part of it that also seems mystifying to me is, like, she's just revealed herself to be someone who should not own a dog. Like, that's all we can conclude from this. Like, you're so careless, you don't understand anything about how to raise and train and care for these animals. Like, you just shouldn't be around them. It just makes her seem so incompetent,
also impulsive. Like, and then she also is like, oh, while I'm killing my animals, I think I'll kill the goat. So she kills this male goat who's been around for a while. Like, the goat is, you know, obviously exhibited some sort of behavior she hasn't liked for a while, but she's like, today seems like the animal killing day, I'm gonna kill the goat. And she doesn't even kill the goat correctly. She like doesn't manage to shoot the goat in such a way that the goat dies. So she leaves the goat, no doubt in agony, in this gravel pit, and then goes back, gets another shell, comes back and succeeds in killing the goat. So, but it's like this kind of why would you want that sort of impulsivity and this sort of like cruelty? That to me doesn't read as I'm a thoughtful, considerate person who should have my finger on.
But here's the question. What are we evaluating here? And what are the set of characteristics that make her disqualified from the job? And why are they only the kinds of characteristics that would make a vice president disqualified when, I mean, Donald Trump hasn't killed any dogs, but he has exhibited cruel behavior in public in a number of different ways. So we don't have to go relitigate the entire Republican primary process, but it does seem to me that this happens in a context. Is it just that basically she has no defenders and wasn't a particularly strong candidate for the vice presidency anyway, so nobody's going to rally to her defense, so it's all one-sided?
Is that the case, John? I don't know. Should she have no chance to be his running mate?
I suppose she has a chance. There are, you know, the state she comes from doesn't particularly help. She is, I don't know what her bridging characteristics are. I mean, obviously she's a woman and that's a constituency Donald Trump needs help with, but I don't know that she is the kind of woman, and particularly now, I think.
Doesn't she seem like a really worse version of Sarah Palin?
I think she doesn't necessarily have the bridge to the suburban Republic. Although, I don't know. If she were a different, I mean, if she weren't, and that this seems to have put her in the kind of Sarah Palin camp, and therefore might not have the outreach to the suburban women that Donald Trump wants. And then, of course, you have to go back to the principle about vice presidents, which is that they don't really matter that much in the end anyway. So, but I don't have a beat at all on what the Donald Trump vice presidential sweepstakes are like. I mean, Rubio and J.D. Vance get mentioned a fair amount, which also suggests another deficiency of Christine Noem, which is that she hasn't publicly, thoroughly, and savagely attacked Trump in both J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio have minted some of the most incisive critiques of Donald Trump. Rubio's in particular, there in 2016, he went on a long jag about his foreign policy expertise in understanding South American countries and the role of dictators and how they fool the populace into supporting them. It's so powerful. You would think it's an AI creation of the present. And J.D. Vance, who said that, you know, once called Trump basically cultural heroin, compared him to Hitler. And now those guys are both in the running. So perhaps Noem, to have a better chance, should have been more critical of Trump.
Can you actually give us a little bit on the sweepstakes, John? I mean, what do you think Trump is looking for? Is there any strategic choice? Is there anyone that would actually hurt him?
So what you get with Trump is that he appears to be doing in this case with his vice president what he did with a lot of other cabinet officials. And I'm not sure that he did with Mike Pence, actually. But anyway, he's having a chat with lots of people, kind of testing out some names and things like that. There's a formal process, but he has his own idiosyncratic process. Rubio checks some interesting boxes. Obviously, he's bilingual. He has strong ties to the foreign policy conversation. And so I'm not sure whether that's a real asset, frankly. Like, how does that actually play out in terms of voters? Does somebody say, because the vice president has a nuanced view of, American anti-terrorism policies, I'm going to vote for the guy at the top of the ticket who has a completely different set of viewpoints on foreign policy. But anyway, that's one of the things that gets mentioned in the Rubio dossier, is that he has this foreign policy experience. The problem with Rubio is, and Emily, you would know this better than I, but the Constitution says you can't have two people from the same state on a ticket. And so
I did not
Rubio,
know that.
Rubio or Trump would have to leave Florida, which actually is not that hard to do. Cheney did it with Texas. He moved back to Wyoming so that he could be on the Bush ticket. And also, like, who's really going to, like, press the point? But obviously somebody will somewhere. So there's some problem there. On the other hand, it really serves Trump's purposes to have Rubio in the conversation, both with, for the help it might give him with Hispanic voters, and also you want Rubio in your team. He would help with those moderate voters to the extent there are any left. And also Rubio dangled the Secretary of State in front of him. So things are looking good for Rubio. And J.D. Vance gets mentioned. He's been a real warrior out there for Trump on TV, which, Trump likes, even though Vance said all these things about Trump cultural heroine, called him loathsome and the rest. He seemed perfectly willing to rewrite everything he previously believed, which is, you know, I wonder for Trump, who has a dominant, one of his strengths and attributes is that he understands dominance in power and enjoys dominance. I wonder if to be a vice president, it requires a certain amount of supplication. That, in other words, he doesn't want somebody that is just going to do the job. He wants someone that is a symbol of his power over the supplicant. And so these people who said these awful things about him have now bent the knee and are every day a reminder of the power of the guy at the top of the ticket. And I think that might be actually appealing to certain voters, and certainly would be appealing to what we know about Donald Trump.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. I'm having some friends for cocktails tonight and thinking about bringing out the vermouth. I think it's summer, time for some red vermouth. So that will be the drink that I am chattering around. Emily, what are you going to be chattering about? And possibly what will you be drinking as you chatter about it?
I am interested in a story this week by Gal Beckerman at The Atlantic. It's about PEN America. It's called A Prominent Free Speech Group is Fighting for Its Life. And it's about a fight at PEN America connected to the war on Gaza, about whether PEN America has been sufficiently denouncing of Israel and done enough for Palestinian writers. And it's a fight that really threatens to pull down PEN America itself. There are some members who just feel like they maybe want to not only call for new leadership, but actually just like tear down the whole organization. And I was interested in it because I just think it's part of an attack on independent institutions on the left as well as the right that are trying to stand for an abstract principle, in this case, like speech and free expression, as opposed to having weighing in only on the side of progressive causes that are linked to speech and free expression. And I thought that Gal Beckerman just did a good job of laying out the issues. So anyway, check it out.
John Dickerson, what is your chatter? You'll be drinking a gin martini. I know that.
I will be. And it's, we're about 28 hours, a little more than that, from when I will get my next one. And,
by the way, listeners, 28 hours puts us at noon on Friday. That's when John thinks he's going to have his first drink.
Well, I was trying to do the math.
Actually, 1 p.m.
I was trying to do the math to think if, you know, maybe 26 hours. by the time I get to Friday, I'm so wrung out that, why not in your cornflakes? As listeners of the show know, I have a fascination with, and it has a super romantic claim on me, the finding of old things that were sitting there for thousands of years waiting to be discovered. And the latest example of this is the discovery of, or the proper location of, Plato's burial place. And it was found by, basically, there was a papyrus scroll 2,000 years ago written on, and it was destroyed, or they thought destroyed, mostly destroyed in the in a volcanic blast of Mount Vesuvius, which extinguished, as we know, the town of Pompeii. So this charred clump of old scroll was nevertheless kept. And now, as a result of two technological advances, scanning technology, which can basically, you know, look through the charred hunk, which you can't open because, it would destroy itself as you open it, but can read the ink based on the carbon, which survived the intense heat, and can figure out what is actually lettering. And then AI, where you can feed information and have it like turn the Rubik's Cube billions of times really quickly, deciphered the 2,000 characters and discovered that, in fact, the philosopher was interred in the gardens of Athens at his academy where he tutored Aristotle. So now, like, they know. And they also know that he was a slave during a certain period. But I love this kind of discovery that was sitting there waiting to be made for 2,000 years and has just now been made.
My chatter is a New York Times photo essay, photographer named Kenny Holston. One of my favorite things in any movie, doesn't really matter what the movie is a scene where a submarine emerges in the Arctic and, like, submarine comes up through the ice in the Arctic And I love any scene. You make a movie, you could make a movie really could be a small domestic comedy, but if
like
it's
a rom-com
emerges,
you're
yeah,
happy.
And submarines emerges in the Arctic, I am there for it. horror movie, I would see a horror movie if it had a submarine emerging. But Kenny Holston went on a nuclear-powered attack submarine, the Hampton, I think it was called, under the Arctic Ocean, or he went to see it emerge in the Arctic Ocean, where they're training for Arctic warfare with various submarines. And there's a photo essay about this, what life is like on a submarine under the Arctic. And it sounds terrible. It sounds absolutely miserable. It sounds like a terrible place to work and live. And I definitely don't want to do it. But the photos are wonderful. And it's just super interesting photo essay in the Times called Inside a Navy Submarine Navigating the Arctic. Listeners, please keep your listener chatters coming. We're in a little bit of a chatter dearth right now. We're having like an Italy birth situation here. We need a few more chatters. So please email them to us at gabfest@slate.com. And our listener chatter this week comes from Christina in Philadelphia.
Hey, Political Gabfest. This is Christina from Philadelphia. My listener chatter is a piece in Vox called Mega Drive-Thrus Explain Everything Wrong with American Cities by Marina Bolotnikova. Marina reports on the rapid expansion of drive-thrus from well-known chains, fast casual brands like Sweetgreen getting into the business, and drive-thru designs with 2, 3, or even 4 lanes for vehicles. Marina coins a new term to describe these changes, the mega drive-thru, that depressingly describes, quote, an urban landscape that is almost paradoxically vast yet dominated by placelessness. Her reporting also touches on the loss of small businesses, urban design that is hostile to pedestrians, and the environmental impacts of idling cars and miles of asphalt. I also see a connection here with the growth of order online and pickup only options and the loss of social third places. Vox's reporting on transportation planning has been stellar. I often think about the great Strode piece from 2022. Talk soon.
That's our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Shana Roth. Our researcher is Julie Hugan. Our theme music is by They Might Be Giants. Ben Richmond is Senior Director for Podcast Operations. And Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Audio for Slate. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. We will talk to you next week. Hi, Slate Plus. How are you? We're joined by Deborah Turkheimer of the Northwestern University Pritzker School of Law. I think everything in Illinois, is it by law, everything has to be named after Pritzker?
We have a lot of Pritzker.
Deb is here to talk to us about why Harvey Weinstein's conviction was overturned by the New York Court of Appeals. So why was it overturned, Deb?
There's David's artful question to start you off.
Well, I mean, it would be weird if he said, she's here to talk about this, and then he said, how do you make a fruit salad?
It would be weird.
Okay, so what happened in Harvey Weinstein's case is that several women who were not the victims of the charged crimes testified against him. There were 3, let's call them additional women. And the Court of Appeals, when the case got to the Court of Appeals, held that that was unfair and that it violated a rule in New York, and this is a common rule, that says that generally a person comes to trial and is only going to face the evidence that pertains to the specific charges and relates very closely to those charges. The Court of Appeals held that the rule was violated in this case, that the trial judge shouldn't have accepted the prosecution's argument, and that it was so...
That was just a snippet from our Slate Plus conversation. If you want to hear the whole conversation, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today.